Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Later on, the AFL-CIO must change.
We're going to hear from Andrew Stern, president of the SEIU, Service Employees International Union. But first,
on He Sails, the Bush administration in rhyme with our extraordinary friend Calvin Trillin. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the deadline poet for The Nation magazine, and just bitingly witty. And you carve away at Cheney and Bush and that administration in a way that I find tremendously uplifting. Good evening from Nova Scotia, Calvin Trillin.
Hello.
Maybe you can give us some of your thoughts, given the reality of the current administration in Washington.
I've talked a little bit about their idea of democracy, and it's in this poetry to a certain extent. For instance, there's something called Dick Cheney's primer on the Constitution, which is, so what's it called if during war you criticize the president for any reason? Treason. And how long does this war go on? And this is where this theory's really pretty clever. Forever. The idea is it's a war, and as long as it's a war, anything goes.
Do you find Bush easier to get a laugh than some of the other politicians?
He's easier than his father, although he has, for my purposes, the same problem with rhymes. I mean, Bush doesn't actually rhyme with anything except tush, which is, I think, disrespectful, so I don't use that. And when his father left office, I wanted to write him a poem, and fortunately he has a lot of middle names, so I did a poem called Farewell to You, George Herbert Walker. Though never treasured as a talker, your predicates were often prone wander noundless, off alone. You did your best in your own way, the way of Greenwich Country Day. So just relax and take your ease and never order Japanese. I get sort of sentimental when they leave. But in fact, this crew, not only Bush, but the people around him, Ashcroft, the person I call Mushroom Cloud Rice, Nanny Dick Cheney.
Why Mushroom Cloud Rice?
Because she said before the war on Iraq, she's the one who kept saying, we don't want the next smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. This was an implication, which is astonishing, since even just by reading the newspapers, I knew that they didn't have any nuclear weapons. This is an implication that Iraq was capable of sending a nuclear bomb through some delivery system to the United States, which was obvious nonsense. So I've always referred to her as Mushroom Cloud Rice. And Supreme Commander Karl Rove and so there always have been a kind of a group of people around him who are interesting.
How about relating that to us through one of your sterling poems?
There's a poem about Ashcroft, which is based on, remember when he was being confirmed as Attorney General. And I have to say, I feel a little responsible for Ashcroft because I'm from Missouri.
I was wondering who we could blame for this. And I'm glad you've given us a face.
No, it's me.
Of all the
Missourians? What happened is that I'm from Missouri, and I have to say that I've been sort of proud over the years that our senators from Missouri are usually pretty reasonable, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. They're decent people. And then Ashcroft came along. I didn't mind so much the fact that he spoke in tongues, but it was the stuff he said in English that really I found embarrassing. And so when his opponent was killed in an airplane crash just before the election, I'm afraid that I had a little talk with God, and I said that if he could see his way clear to having Ashcroft loose to an opponent who wasn't even alive, anything else in the election was okay with me. So you have to be careful what you ask for. And then during his confirmation, people remember we're looking for this speech he gave at Bob Jones University, which was really sort of the place that Bush went in South Carolina when it looked like McCain, who had beaten him in New Hampshire, was going to get the nomination, and was known for basically racism and various things. And it turned out that what Ashcroft had said was that the difference between America and all other countries was that the only king we have is Jesus. So I wrote a poem called The Only King We Have Is Jesus, a newly unearthed gospel song credited to John Ashcroft. First couple of stanzas are, As I told the Bob Jones students seated white and black apart, this nation is unique, not like the rest. As I faced those godly youngsters, I told them from the heart just why this land will always be the best. The only king we have is Jesus, and I feel blessed to bring that news. The only king we have is Jesus. I can't explain why we've got Jews. Then the final chorus is sung in tongues. Tron smlek god dreedness hoke baloof knock. Frack fark frack fag nars fag maduna grieb. Tron smlek god dreedness hoke baloof knock. Dar popish flarge dure darky heeb. That's a poem about John Ashcroft.
And what about Nanny Dick Cheney?
I did a poem about Nanny Dick Cheney when George Bush said he would testify before the 9/11 Commission, but only with the vice president, who I call Nanny Dick. I wrote a poem called I Can't Appear Without My Nanny Dick. When called upon to testify, I said I was a busy guy, so maybe we could do it on the phone. They really want a face-to-face. I said, okay, if that's the case, I'm certainly not doing it alone. I can't appear without my Nanny Dick. For Nanny Dick, I've got a serious Jones. I can't appear without my Nanny Dick. I love the way he cocks his head and drones. Cartoonist show me as a dummy with voice by Cheney or by Rummy. I am the butt of every late-night satirist. But I just can't go solitaire. I need the help that's due an heir. I need a dad, and dad's a multilateralist. I can't appear without my Nanny Dick. He brings along a gravitas I lack. I can't appear without my Nanny Dick, the one who knows why we attacked Iraq. Yes, Condi Rice is quite precise with foreign policy advice on who's Afghani and who's Pakistani. I like to have her near in case I just can't play some foreign face. But Condoleezza Rice is not my nanny. I can't appear without my Nanny Dick. I wouldn't know which facts I should convey. I can't appear without my Nanny Dick. It's Nanny Dick who tells me what to say.
Profoundly irreverent, but this type of poetry, this sardonic witticisms, I'm amazed that you actually get away with some of them since they are pretty aggressively strong.
I think that a lot of times when things rhyme, they seem less harmful or offensive than things that don't rhyme. I mean, I remember, for instance, several years ago, I was having trouble with rhyming the name of Al D'Amato, the senator from New York. I know it rhymes with tomato, but I'm from Missouri, and I just couldn't bring myself to say tomato. I finally realized that it rhymed with sleazeball obligato, and that turned out to be okay. But I think in prose I would hesitate to say that. I think that the fact that things rhyme sort of takes the curse off of them.
Maybe we should offer Michael Moore that suggestion for his next film as he becomes subject to the outrageous slings and arrows of right critics.
It could be an iambic pentameter. I think that Michael Moore is going to get attacked anyway. But still, he could maybe cut it down a little bit with iambic pentameter.
Are there some other readings that you'd like to do for us?
I could do a reading on what happened. Remember when Osama bin Laden, just after the 9/11 attacks, we said we were going to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive and all that sort of thing. And then the Bush administration did something really brilliant when it became obvious they weren't going to be able to find him. They quit talking about him. They just kind of cut him off. It was like one of those Soviet encyclopedias, remember in the old days, where they just sort of dropped a guy out of there. And I did a poem called We Speak Not of Osama, with apologies to Cole Porter, who wrote My Heart Belongs to Daddy. The towers fell, we knew full well the villain in this awful drama. His name held sway till he got away. Now we speak not of Osama. We said we'd pound him once he's found so flat that he'd cry for his mama. Forget that jive, that dead or alive, 'cause we speak not of Osama. He's not even in the axes. No, his evil did not make the grade. For the thing he mostly lacks is a country that we can invade. He could be in Yokohama or Bahrain or Belize or Dubai, but to get back at Osama, we'll just pulverize some other guy. Then I wrote a lot of poems about the people I call the Sissy Hawks.
Oh, I love that, yes.
These are people who were the sort of architects of the war and who were, I think, just about to a man, people who evaded the draft in the Vietnam War, which they were also very much for, but not to the point of wanting to participate in it. I did a poem called Richard Pearl, Whose Fault Is He? And I did a poem called A Sissy Hawk Cheer. Bomb 'em now, kill 'em now, zim boom ba, sissy hawks, rah rah rah. Vietnam reverberates, we were rooting from the States. All-out war is still our druthers, fiercely fought, fought by others. Hit 'em now before things worsen, we love war, though not in person. Bomb 'em now, kill 'em now, zim boom ba, sissy hawks, rah rah rah.
We would be remiss if we didn't do something about Richard Pearl. And you started it. It's your fault. You mentioned him.
I did this piece about this poem about Richard Pearl and said basically the problem was that he was sort of bullied in fourth grade. So he's now getting back by being this tough guy. And I said at the end of the poem, and he's got planes and ships and tanks and guns, all manned, of course, by other people's sons. Then I had totally made this up just looking at Pearl. I didn't know anything about his background or anything. And then about a week later, I got a phone call from somebody I'd met about 20 years before, and he said his wife went to school with Richard Pearl, and he wanted to know, and her friends wanted to know, how did I know that he had been bullied? And so I said, my God, you can't even invent a slander in this country anymore. And then the Nation got a letter from somebody defending Richard Pearl, saying he was really a very serious boy, but maybe not completely a wimp and a nerd and all the things I said he was. So I called this guy's wife and got a few pieces of verisimilitude, and then I answered in the Nation, you were not one of the fourth grade girls who used to push Richard down the hill on Fuller Street, and you didn't laugh once in sixth grade when Rocco Gunterman from Mrs. Flynn's class referred to Richard as Pearly Girl? Fine, whatever you say. If the United States invades Iraq without provocation, it won't be your fault. And then she wrote again. She said that she was in Mrs. Flynn's class, and Richard lived on Fuller Street, but she didn't remember Rocco Gunterman. There wasn't any Rocco Gunterman. And so I said, I suppose Rocco Gunterman, the classmate whose existence you deny, did not say to me just last week, we can settle this if Pearly Girl meets me near the swings at 5 o'clock on Friday and tell him not to bring two teachers and his mother this time. Would it surprise you to learn that Rocco is now a psychotherapist in Sherman Oaks?
What a nice thing now to begin to be on the precipice of having films like The Corporation, films like Michael Moore's, certainly Fahrenheit 9/11, and books like yours that are reaching such tremendous importance and prominence in our society. It certainly does say something, I think, about the ideological sway of considerable numbers of people that we might not have thought. After all, I guess maybe we are the majority.
Is it obliviously or is
obliviously,
it
obliviously?
Yeah.
Obliviously. That's half okay. Of a poem that I wrote when his college transcript was revealed, which is obliviously on he sails with marks not quite as good as quails.
Quail, God.
We're just about out of time. People should definitely go and get Obliviously on He Sails, The Bush Administration in Rhyme by Calvin Trillin. And you can read the poetry of Mr. Trillin, the deadline poet in The Nation, and also, of course, a staff writer for The New Yorker. Any next project immediately coming up?
No, I'm in Nova Scotia where I live in the summer, and I'm just thinking of maybe chilling out for a while.
How's the locks up there?
It's so good they don't even call it locks.
Okay.
Well, Calvin Trillin, thank you for being with us.
This is for all you big government Wall Street types. Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other, he was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking, they didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. If a single one of them are in cahoots, he's running the U.S., Europe, and Russia too. He's a white man in a business suit.
I bet you're going to talk about the conference of the SEIU.
And what does SEIU mean?
A Service Employees International Union.
And what union did John Sweeney come out of?
Service Employees International Union. And John Sweeney is the president of the AFL-CIO.
And it's been 9 years since he came to the AFL-CIO, ousting Lane Kirkland, demanding that the AFL-CIO make changes to revive the labor movement, and the labor movement still has not revived, and a number of different unions now, including his successor at the Service Employees International Union, whose name is Stern, is calling for new changes. Now what they're talking about is structural changes in the AFL-CIO, and they're going to bring it up at the AFL-CIO conference and Mr. Stern at the last SEIU convention made a speech hinting at the direction of those changes, which there'll be more information about that. They don't want to get into too much of it before the presidential elections. And this is the biggest union in the country, the Service Employees International Union. So now we're going to hear from Andrew Stern, president of the SEIU, talking about what's going to happen in the AFL-CIO, at least what he wants to happen.
And we know that even if we build strength in our industry and strength in our nations, no one union can succeed as an island of strength in a non-union sea. As the largest union, it is our job to help rebuild labor strength. Next June, the AFL-CIO will celebrate its 50th anniversary. At the time it was established, one out of every three workers in the U.S. was in a union. I mean, labor's industry strength was a vehicle for millions to join the middle class. And private workers then used their strength to win collective bargaining rights for people in the public sector. And union wages and union benefits back then brought everyone up. Today, with only 1 in 12 workers in the private sector in unions, and less than 1 in 8 workers in unions overall, non-union wages at companies like Walmart's are dragging us all down. Our employers have changed, our industries have changed, the world has changed. But the labor movement's structure and the labor movement's culture has stayed the same. John Sweeney is a good man, and he tried to breathe new life into the AFL-CIO. But John Sweeney has proven the problem is not who captains the ship, but that the ship was not built to navigate the storms of this modern world. The AFL-CIO itself is a loose trade association of 65 separate and autonomous unions instead of a strong, united organization. It's a structure that divides workers' strength by allowing each union to organize in any industry, then bargain on their own, even when workers need the strength that comes from sharing each other's strength with common employers. And sadly, as the AFL-CIO is set up today, I believe it has no hope of uniting the 90% of workers who have no union at all in America. With an SEIU, when our own policies, traditions, or interests, or even individual leaders kept unite workers from uniting their strength, we changed them. And sisters and brothers, it is time, it is so long overdue, that we join with our union allies and either change the AFL-CIO or build something stronger that can really change workers' lives. see we're ready to build new labor strength. One more reason the labor movement needs an overhaul is it's not set up to deal with today's growing global economy or growing multinational companies. Today's global corporations have no permanent home. They recognize no national borders and salute no flag but their own corporate logo. And they take their money to anywhere where they can make the most and pay the least. Maybe you've heard of these multi-service outsourcing industry, or maybe you know the industry's largest companies, Sodexo, based in France, operating in 76 countries. Compass, based in Great Britain, operating in 90 companies. Or Aramark, now based in the US, but already operating in 19 countries around the world. Today, those three companies employ 1.1 million workers, are growing fast in cleaning, food service, laundry, transportation, and maintenance, and anything else that can be contracted out in schools, universities, government, office buildings, hospitals, and nursing homes. Does anybody here think that their job is safe in this new global economy from these new multi-service outsourcing companies? Looks like most of you understand that these three global service companies, the way their growth is going, these three companies will soon have more workers than Walmart. Now think about it. You know, it's easy to criticize the United Food and Commercial Workers Union for not having an early and effective response to Walmart's rapid expansion. But brothers and sisters, don't get too smug or self-righteous, because now every one of us is facing the same challenge with the same three companies. They are our Walmart. And they're not only signs of globalization that are knocking on our door. A global challenge requires a global solution. So today I'm asking you, SEIU's 21st century leaders, to decide to go where no union has ever gone before, to authorize SEIU to build the first truly global union outside North America, around the world, from coast to coast, border to border, across ocean, and build a truly global union in SEIU. The strength to win global agreements from global employers and unite workers, whether they do the same type of work in Albany, New York, or Adelaide, Australia, whether they do the same type of work in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, or Stockholm, Sweden, San Juan, Puerto Rico, or Sao Paulo, Brazil. To our union allies who are here from around the world, I ask that we join forces to learn from each other and replace old, outdated, weak international relationships with real strategies and real unities. We can build that strength worldwide. And today I want to send this message to every emerging global corporation in this world. Justice, family, community, and union are the same in every language. And wherever you go and whatever you do, a new global labor movement is coming after you. Uniting the labor movement in our own countries and working with our allies around the world is important. But even if we do, we still can't do the job alone. We also need the community strength that comes from alliances with the people our members serve every day and with organizations that share our goals. At this convention, you will be asked to approve a report of the Social and Economic Justice Committee to strengthen our work in our communities, with a focus on two core issues that affect us all. First, the right of all Americans to have what we envy from our Canadian sisters and brothers, a quality, affordable healthcare system for every man, woman, and child in our country. We want what our brothers and sisters in Canada have shown us is important in North America. And secondly, the social and economic justice calls for a focus on a pathway to legalization for all hardworking taxpaying immigrants as well. But in the 21st century, we also need to draw our strength from the new forms of community that are developing because of the internet, which is connecting millions of people who want to take action and want to get involved. We need those people to be part of our movement as well. So I'm asking you to authorize SEIU to create Purple Ocean, the world's first open source virtual labor union, with a goal of uniting 1 million more of our allies who want to join with us in our campaigns for justice. And between our internet leak community and our current members and community allies, we're going to build the biggest movement for social and economic justice on the ground, in the air, and on the internet this world has ever seen. Are you ready to build community strength in our union? Building on these strengths, we have a chance to make changes that will help working people win, not just in our union, but around the whole world. We can bring to earth a new world from the ashes of the old, because our union transforms us, the once powerless, into the powerful. And I ask you to join together in using all that power, all that strength, to make the dreams of all workers and all communities around this world come true. And if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? Thank you very much.
You were listening to SEIU President Andrew Stern calling for structural changes in the AFL-CIO.
And while he wasn't specific as to what those changes were, this was sort of like a warning shot across the bow for the struggles of the next year to make changes at the Federation level. So we'll see what happens.
And I can't help but mention there was one incredibly important thing that happened at the SEIU convention. One of the largest labor unions in the country has called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Very, very important.
It's the biggest union in the country and the second biggest, which is the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, also called for the immediate withdrawal. The two biggest unions in the country.
Fabulous. It's a long time in coming because they really hadn't done that at all during the Vietnam War, so it's good that it is happening now, and it's taken a year in this war, but it is of grave significance that the two largest unions are calling for a withdrawal of the troops.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And to find out more about Building Bridges, you can go to our website at www.buildingbridgesonline.org.